Hey folks, I know you're listening to this podcast right now, but do you know you could be watching this conversation in glorious, high-definition black and white? That's right, for those of you who don't know or have not experienced off-camera as a television show, you're missing out on a whole nother dimension of the conversation. So if you haven't checked it out, go right now to offcamera.com and look at our monthly subscription. In 5 minutes, you could be watching any of our over 130 archived episodes on any device, your television, your iPad, your phone. For only $4.99 a month, you can have complete access to our archive, plus to the new shows when we post them. It's a great way to experience off-camera, and it supports the show. So if you don't have DirecTV and you want to watch off-camera, check out our monthly subscription by going to offcamera.com. You'll be glad you did. Now, on to the main event. Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with comedian, actor, TV show creator, writer, and Pete Holmes expert, Pete Holmes. When I was preparing to sit down with Pete, I realized the big question on my mind was, just how far does Pete's HBO series Crashing delve into autobiographical territory? How much of his story has been fictionalized and dramatized for viewers' entertainment? Well, as I found out a few minutes into the conversation, TV Pete and the Pete sitting in the chair across from me are virtually the same person. He is the guy who lived alone in a garage, post-divorce, consoling himself with Chinese food and his own low-main pleasure. And he is the guy that bombed on stage regularly in front of 10 people for many years. And, according to Pete, learning to be comfortable with yourself is the key to success in stand-up. Although Crashing may offer a romantic view of the early years of stand-up comedy, it is also a spot-on portrayal of the loneliness and desperation that so many stand-ups go through on their way to success. And Pete noticed that shows about stand-up comics, like Seinfeld and Everybody Loves Raymond, routinely skip over those early years of struggle. That's where Pete found his sweet spot, creating a show so personal, so real, that even he had to ask the HBO executives if it was too inside baseball. Well, no, it's not, and that deep dive into the details of the struggle make his show one of the most original on television. Pete wasn't always so sure about sharing his personal and often embarrassing past, and it didn't help that his own parents questioned not only his career choices, but his desire to open up publicly about the details of his divorce. So in 2012, he started a podcast called You Made It Weird and began testing just how far he could go into the intimate details of his quote-unquote failures. And what did he find out? That the more specific he was about his own vulnerabilities, the more people started to connect with him. And the more he shared the embarrassing details of his life, the less alone he felt. Talking to Pete, I realized that it takes a lot of courage to be yourself, especially when you're doing it on stage, nightly, in front of often hostile crowds. And it has given him an edge that he feels he shares with stand-up comedians, which can be helpful not only at dinner parties, but when defending your love for the Lumineers. So pull up a chair and listen in.
Hi, Pete.
Hi, Sam.
Hi, Pete.
Hi, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me. I mean it. This is
fun. I mean it, too.
I never get to be a guest.
Really?
Are you also guest neglected? Neglected?
You know what? I don't get to be a guest way more often than you don't get to be a guest, I'm sure.
I get to be a guest more is what you're saying.
Yes.
I just want to be clear.
That was the double negative.
I liked it.
Yeah.
Siamese twins, you and me.
Yeah. Mm. Are there Siamese twins anymore?
They just, yeah, for sure.
But they fix it before anyone sees them.
I don't know. What?
We just lost every Siamese twin, and that's like double the viewers.
Oh, okay. I don't endorse this line of humor. I'm
all
just
right.
Kidding.
All right, well, let's start over.
I don't think it was offensive at all.
Okay, good.
I think you're good.
I don't find you offensive at all.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
A lot of people think that I'm clean, which is funny.
You know, I think that's old news on you, and people get the one-line Wikipedia thing, and they go, oh, he works clean.
Yeah.
And I would say that the last special I watched of yours, because I should say, I came late to the Pete Holmes experience.
And, experience.
Yeah. And I came from crashing last year. It was recommended to me, and I watched it, and I fell in love with it, and I said, we got to get this guy on the show, because it's a great, authentic look into the romantic indie band version of being a comic, like the early years.
The early years.
Yeah.
And I like that you said romantic. That's exactly what it is. I feel romantic about the hard years.
Like
every person that's climbed any sort of ladder, socially or in your job or whatever, you look back on the time when you were suffering and it really stunk. And crashing is sort of like a celebration of if it stinks, you're doing it right. Like it stunk for Seinfeld and it stunk for Chris Rock. It stunk for all these other great comics. So my character is kind of in that warm, uncomfortable place.
But I also would say that once you make it, and you're flying around on private jets
It's a different show at that point. It's called Entourage.
That's right.
Also on HBO. Also available now. Go and now. And go now.
But it's true. It's like we always look back on those struggling years with a romantic lens because we had those triumphs at the end of each day when you did get through a day and something worked.
And on Crashing, which is about what it's like becoming a stand-up in New York City specifically, we do speed it up a little bit. You have to.
Sure.
Because it takes years and years and years. But it's based on things that I really did, like warm up. Like I really did warm up, which is the comedian that comes out before a live TV taping.
Right, like on Rachel Ray or Dr. Oz.
Exactly. Yeah. And what I did was on The Daily Show, which was awesome. But I would come out and just kind of do my act and a lot of like, where's you from? And let's get the claps going. And then I'd bring out Jon Stewart. But a lot of people didn't know that that's one of the side jobs that's kind of like comedy. I don't want to say it's comedy adjacent because it is comedy, but it's certainly nothing anybody plans to really do. So my character, who's also named Pete, just kind of keeps falling into these strange opportunities that I get really excited that people don't know about. They don't know. I don't know if people have good guesses on what it is, what it means to become a comedian. Meaning like you have a day job and you're handing out flyers, which, you know, we call barking, to get on stage. And I love kind of, we always want the scripts to be really funny, obviously, but I also like the added bonus of telling secrets about show business.
Yeah.
What it really is. Because we have plenty of movies and TV shows, I think, where somebody's like, I'm going to be a stand-up, and they start going to open mics or whatever, and then there's just like a dissolve, or maybe in your case, an out-of-focus to focus, and suddenly the person is a comedian.
Yes.
Like Louis and Seinfeld.
And on Seinfeld, their shows. A great example, because there was, like, you could do a prequel to Seinfeld and see those years.
Wouldn't that be
better?
I would love that.
Yeah.
I don't know if we were ready for it culturally.
Maybe not. Maybe we didn't have the pioneering shows that
made us ready.
That taught networks and studios that these stories are every bit as good as.
And I would say things like this, podcasts and the way that show business has kind of let its guard down and now audiences are welcomed into the personal lives and the inner lives of comedians. People now expect a deeper dive on their TV shows.
Yes.
And I know HBO is very good about that. Like season two, we start getting into the difference between the alt scene, which is the alternative comedy scene, and the club scene. And I was worried that Casey Bloys, the head of HBO, I was like, I don't know if this is too inside baseball. And he was like, the more inside baseball, the better. Like he was like, that's what makes this show special. And I think that's one of the things that makes it HBO special is they trust the audience enough to be like, we're just going to show what it is. Maybe we'll be saying some words that you don't understand, but just like a child learning a new language, you'll figure it out very quickly. And then you'll get to be on the ins.
Well, that's what I love from
be on the ins.
From season one to season two, it seems like.
Did you see some?
I did. I've seen six of season two.
You've seen six?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Sam saw six.
Yeah. Nate saw them too.
I don't want Nate seeing them.
Actually, a lot of people saw them because we put them up on the internet. And you know what, by the way? A lot of people are liking them.
That's funny because if that were true, I would have a unique cocktail of like, oh no, and did they like
exactly.
Like my corporate oh no.
I do have to sue you, but before I do.
You're going down.
Can I look at the market research?
What did you think?
Yeah.
Oh, that's like the old joke where a comedian, somebody gets murdered during a comedy show and they go to the MC and they're like, we need to talk to everybody that was here. Somebody was murdered during the show, and the MC goes, early show or late show? Which is just like, that's, we just did a modern version of that joke.
That's right, that's right. I was like, oh, exactly.
You shouldn't have done that. How to play.
Yeah, how to play.
How to play.
Well, what I like about the second season is that it seems like now the show can be anything. It's almost like you had to have the structure up front.
I mean, that's it.
For people who don't know, the show starts with an implosion. You're living out in upstate New York with your wife. You've gotten married very young. This is all very autobiographical. Mm-hmm. You're trying to make it as a comedian. Your wife doesn't really understand or support this whole idea mm-hmm. of you making no money, bombing in the clubs and coming home,
right.
not having a real job. She's supporting you.
Right.
And one day you come home and you find her in bed with another guy and yeah. your life implodes.
After I was giving her what's known as the full package.
That's right.
I had no money, no prospects, and I was always home. Except when she wanted me there. I don't know why. That's like
exactly.
a real, that's, I'm like Antonio Banderas. Like a sexy, sexy, tall drink of man.
Oh, not like Antonio Banderas in Shrek, when you're a cat.
Ah, Puss in Boots reference.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm going to have to up my game.
I feel like I'm on a Nerdist podcast now. I just made an obscure reference.
I liked it. It wasn't obscure enough because my
it
mom,
wasn't.
She has a Puss in Boots magnet. So I mean, oh, my mom gets it. We're on the right side of weird. Or the wrong side.
Whose show? Am I on your show or are you on my show?
I am talking way more than you are, and I apologize.
No, that's what guests are supposed to do.
Okay. Wait, what you were saying?
Oh, so what I was saying was that...
Oh, my wife leaves me, yes.
Yeah, and the show starts with this implosion, and it's basically, the show starts right at the apex of your old life ending and your new life beginning.
Yes.
And the show's called Crashing, and it's a double entendre that refers to bombing on stage and also sleeping on other comedians' couches.
Yep.
And I think what's interesting is that the whole first season's marketing campaign was wrapped around that, too. The, you know, you're on a couch yep. in the middle of a street, and that's how it's sold. Once the audience buys into the premise, it's almost like it frees you up to do anything,
totally.
And it seems like you're taking advantage of that.
Completely. You can just kind of hit the ground running. Like, we don't have to demonstrate the premise over and over. People
right.
kind of get it. Like Judd Apatow, who's the executive producer, was very careful to be like, we need to know where he is in life. Where is he financially? Where is he spiritually? Where is he in his friend's circle? Like, we need to know all that stuff. Now we just kind of know. And the second season picks up very close to the first season
right.
ending. And I'm very lonely. The second season opens, it won't ruin anything. It's just a micro moment. But
sure.
Pete's eating Chinese food alone in his sad garage apartment. And he's masturbating.
Yeah.
And like, to me, as someone who really was divorced, my wife really did have an affair and she left me, I was like, on TV, and again, I'm not putting down these shows, I just think we could use a deeper dive, and that's kind of what we're talking about, into what it's like to be divorced, what it's like to be left.
Yeah.
And the deeper dive, and it's barely deeper, because in other movies and TV I've seen, a guy's wife leaves, and there's always kind of like, he's sad, so we show him going to a bar, because that's what you do when you're sad. Like
you want to drink alone.
Talk to a stranger.
Yeah.
Yeah, like you want everyone to see you drinking alone, and you tell everyone, she left me.
You know, it's yeah. funny you say that, because...
And then you go, and then you have sex with 30 women. Like there's a montage
yes.
of like,
yes.
and then he's off the leash. I'm like, really? Because my wife left me, and I didn't want to touch another person for 6 months. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
you're sad. Like, that's the thing... Not that all women are guilty, obviously, but you see a woman and it reminds you of the thing that just ripped your heart out. So you're not going to be like, all right, let's get mingling. You know
yeah,
what I mean? You're
yeah.
like Chinese food and jerking off. That's it. So I was happy to bring that to the screen.
Well, I think you've identified two of the paramours of loneliness right there.
That's it.
Chinese food.
Counseling yourself with lo mein and counseling yourself with your own lo mein. I don't know. Mine's thin like a noodle.
Well,
make that into a meme. Mine's thin like a noodle.
I was going to say that I think the best comedy is personal. That may have crossed the line into the
my
personal we don't want to know.
My low main joke?
Yeah.
Look, man, I have to live with it. You have to hear about it.
Yeah, you're right. For you, it's a 24-hour nightmare. For me, it's one time where we remember
terrible.
Later. Remember when Pete told us about his lo mein? Then we move on. No, but I think that what makes your entire deal so interesting to me is it's almost like your art has become your autobiography. Mm. Like through this show Crashing and using that as a reference when we listen to your podcast or when we watch your stand-up specials, we are getting all of you. And mm-hmm. was it a conscious choice to say, okay, I am going to not hide behind anything. I'm not going to try to control what people think of me or how they see me.
Well, isn't that the point of life? It's certainly one of them. It's one choice you could take on as the point of life. It happened after my divorce. Years and years and years went by. I never talked about it. And I wouldn't say I was shy, but I was private, certainly about things that seemed like failures.
Right.
You know, there were people that called my divorce kind of like a failure. They'd say, I call these people my dad. <You know>? he didn't mean it in a mean way. He was just kind of like, does that bother you to have a failure like that? And I was like, so I kind of kept it to myself. And
was it a failure to you originally when it happened?
It was, I don't think so. Yes, I think it felt like a failure a little bit. But then with time and perspective, you go, just because things end doesn't make them failures. You know what I mean? That relationship did wonderful things for me as a person, and it ending did things that are truly wonderful as well. When I decided to make a TV show about it, my parents were confused. They were like, why are you telling everybody about the worst thing that happened to you?
Right.
And I was like, because if you tell people about the worst thing that happened to you, you realize that they've just been sitting on the worst thing that happened to them. And that feels really good for us to make jokes and kind of find the lighter side and some of the wisdom that comes through those painful experiences and bring them into a story like Crashing, which is hopefully what we're doing. So I think it's weird. Like, I was raised religious. I thought I was going to be a pastor. Then my wife leaves me. And then I kind of fell into the deep end of stand-up comedy. I thought that was, like, very unique, obviously. I was like, I don't know if there's a lot of people like that. Turns out there are a lot of people like that. There's differences. But there are a lot of people that got married. I'm talking about in real life now.
Too young.
Too young. Very young. First person they were ever with, basically. First girlfriend. Get married. And then 6 years in, 7 years in, the seven-year itch kind of thing. The wife cheats. Sometimes it's the husband cheats. Somebody cheats. It ends. And then that's when people talk about, like, not always, but a lot of people that come up to me often want to share the story that was their launch pad. That led them to the self-exploration and the inner work that helped them figure out what really makes them happy. It's a starting over.
Right.
It's like grace. You know what I mean? It's like both the fall and the recovery are grace. And that's it, you can't tell that to someone who just fell, but later you can make a show about it. And then people go, that was right on.
And then they connect.
Yeah, hopefully.
But in your stand-up, I'm assuming this shift to personal material happened much earlier than the show, where you sort of had to go through that.
That's so funny. Like, for the first 5 years, maybe 10, most comedians are just doing, it's like they have a Vitamix and they just put in, like me, it was like Steve Martin and Seinfeld, and then you put in like Brian Regan and you blend it up, and then you reek of it. You think no one's noticing. Remember when you were like 12 and you thought, maybe if I just walk like a grown-up, people will think I'm 30? Like, nobody's buying it. So stand-ups get on stage and they're like, what's the situation with? And it's like, he changed deal to situation. We all see it. It smells like, like a fart in an elevator. Everyone knows. What I'm saying is, the job of the comedians that I like, and this isn't true of all comedians, but a lot of the guys that I like Bill Burr, Marc Maron is a great example of this. I learned a lot of these things from these guys, is if you can get on stage and they already know who you are from your podcast or your previous specials and stuff, there's a shorthand and you can get to the funny faster.
Right, right.
So a podcast is a really good kind of sidecar to a comedian's motorcycle, because now when I go out, they know if I reference DC Talk or something from the New Testament, they understand my perspective, and they know this, and this about me.
You don't need as much setup.
Absolutely. Now, when I do, I just got remarried, and it's been about a month and a half.
Congratulations.
Thank you kindly.
Try to hold on to this one.
Thank you. Shit. I shouldn't be here. I should be rubbing her feet.
Cut to 10 years from now, and there's a new show called, It Happened Again.
Oh, my God. What am I doing wrong? So she's lovely and wonderful, and her name's Valerie. And what's funny is when I do shows now, stand-up shows, if I say my wife or something, people will yell out Valerie. They know. And you'd think that might be creepy, but what we're trying to do is manufacture, when you're doing stand-up, it's kind of like the feeling of a dinner party. Have you ever arrived to a dinner party late? Everyone's seated and they're all together. They were individuals, now they're merging into a group, an audience. And then in comes old late guy,
And the expectation is, here's new guy. As primates, we haven't adjusted to this man's pheromones. Right. And like, new guy's here. And they're like, let's listen to new guy. And that's what stand-up is. So if you, the first 10 years of stand-up, you get to, I always had to address how tall I was, for example. I'd have to be like, I'm 6'6". And then you'd have to be like, I look like lesbian Val Kilmer. And everyone laughs. Address your appearance. And then you're like, I'm from Boston. I was raised religious. My wife loved me. You have to get, you're 20 minutes in before you're really getting into right. the grit. But now you can go out and hit the ground running. This is one of the best things to all the people that do stand-up out there. It really does get richer and richer because people know who Bill Burr is. So he can come out and just be like, nah, I'm serious. You see these microphones, fucking bullshit? And everyone's like, he's doing what he does. And that's a wonderful feeling to yeah. be able to jump to that with an audience. And the audience enjoys it too. That's what Crashing Season 2 is. We know the situation, we know the setup. So I would say as a whole, Season 2 is far funnier, which I love to say, because obviously I'm a comedian, I want to make people laugh. And we can move a little bit quicker, like get into more interesting stories, more interesting secrets, and a little bit more heart, because we don't have to go, meet Pete. Pete's married, but something's fishy. Honey. We can just be like, remember that? All right, let's talk.
And I will also posit that the funny isn't even what draws me to the show as much as the moments where there's this real human being that I'm seeing and I'm identifying with. A couple moments that come up to mind are you're out with this woman who's a great comedian and you like her and there's a little attraction there. And I think, you know, the first time you sleep with her and the next morning, you know, you have to pee, so you go pee and you leave the door open and you're just you.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm in that situation, I got to be honest with you, I'm holding it till I leave.
Yeah.
Trying to be, you know.
Fun. I know exactly what you mean.
And I think that what I like about your show, and it's very funny and it's obviously about comedy, but it's also about a guy who is unapologetically himself in every right. situation and can't help it.
He hasn't yet learned the bad habit of not being himself.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad to hear you say that, because that's not really something that I tried to do, but I just would remember who that guy was. And like using the bathroom and just being like, I don't care.
A sit pee.
Because he's hungover, so the room is, so he sits.
You don't want to stand in the morning when you're hungover.
I also, honestly, I just don't want to ever stand. It's nicer to sit. Anyway.
We have a heated seat now.
It's more comfortable. That's what I'm saying. I have a heated seat.
Oh, isn't it great?
It's great. You didn't know you wanted it.
No.
And once Welcome I had back it, to Los Angeles
I can't live
jerks.
Without it. I actually got my heated seat for my birthday.
It's one, and you know what? It's not that fancy. Amazon.
No.
Get yourself a heated seat.
People.
Toast those buns. And well, you know what else is great? Footy pajamas. And I'm talking about like a whole adult onesie.
Do they make them for your size?
They do. Double X, baby.
Really?
Yeah. And then they got the butt flap, like I'm looking for gold in them darn hills. And then I'm unzipping, pressing my hams on a heat seat, sit peeing.
But where does the flap, hit the toilet? And get?
No, you know, it's baggy.
So it hangs in an area where you, when you put it back up, you're not laying
you have to be
the
careful.
Floor on your butt.
It's not the floor and you're not peeing on it. You're good.
Okay.
What's it called? Forever Lazy is the one that I bought. But listen, what were we saying? Sit pee. Oh, so Pete doesn't know, and he's far more comfortable with intimacy than he is with like one night stands. And I think that, again, it wasn't intentional. We're just telling the story of the kind of guy I was at this time in my life, which is very guileless, very earnest, very simple and sweet. But that can be very annoying, and that can be misinformed, and that can be ill-directed. It's not like he's a perfect person, but he's hopefully likable because you're like, he's not a scumbag. He's not trying to like get famous or rich or get drinks and drugs. And he's not even trying to like have multiple hookups. He's just like a sweet guy who likes comedy so much and likes other comedians so much. So he just kind of goes around soaking it up and enjoying it.
Well, there's a scene in the second season of The Comedian's Table. Maybe it's at the Comedy Cellar.
Mm-hmm.
And
which is, can I interject Sammy Boy?
Yeah.
I'm just so thrilled. That's the real comedy. You know what I mean? Like we're shooting
you get
in
to
the
shoot
cellar
in the real at the place where all
a
this stuff
happened. Table I didn't used to be allowed to sit at, which is good. That's how it should be. You're supposed to earn it. But now we're shooting there with the real guys and kind of capturing some of the fun of how they make fun of each other and all that sort of. It's kind of roasty in that area. Not as
Very
much as
much
it
so.
Used to be.
And it made me question how you dealt with that period of your life of questioning yourself, am I good enough? Can I be quick enough to be at this table?
Right.
You know, the 10,000 hours versus am I born with this kind of thing? And and how you can probably lose faith in yourself as a comedian if you jump too many steps ahead and find yourself near that table or at that table.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think one of the worst things that could happen is a break before you're ready. Because when you're in anonymity, nobody cares. Like, you're free to fail. And that's really where you learn. I think that's one of the reasons why stand-ups become better faster than, and I don't have the research for this.
You don't have the raw data.
I'm positing. I don't have the raw data. But then a writer, meaning, I do both. But a writer, it's in a vacuum. You get feedback later. Plus, failing as a writer isn't as painful as being up there, deer in the headlights, scared. So there's literally something very kind of primal going on that you better make your jokes better or you're going to feel pain. And that's like, it's one of the it's almost like boxing. If you don't get faster and quicker, you're going to keep getting punched in the face by the audience and sometimes by other comedians, but definitely by the audience. So you have this, you have a greater motivating force behind you than just maybe I'll send this to my editor and he won't like it.
Right. And then I can go back into my cave and no one will know and I'll try again.
Imagine if you're standing in front of 70 editors and sometimes they're drunk and sometimes they're yelling and the author before you is Dave Chappelle. I mean, like, you have to grow.
That sounds terrible.
It does sound terrible. And that's kind of one of the things about the show. And one of the things I think makes it hopefully likable is the way that I feel about comedians is anybody that's willing to risk that sort of humiliation has to love it. And in all movies and all TV, we tend to love people that are doing what they ought to be doing.
Yes.
And what's written on their bones. That's something that I tell a lot of people. A lot of people think they want to be comedians or they want to be actors or whatever it might be. I like to say, with love, I go, follow the dream that's also following you. You know what I mean? It's like, meet the dream in the middle, but see which one's coming your way, where your talents lie, where your instincts lie, what's really inside of you. Because you can't just pick the one that has the most glamour. You have to be a little delusional, but don't be too delusional.
Okay, so that's interesting, because it is on
a
spectrum.
Curve. Yeah, you should be right here in your delusion.
And I wondered if that came from personal experience of wondering if you belonged where you were trying to go.
Well, it's interesting. Like, I'll give you an example. I'd be at the Boston, and Chappelle used to come by all the time. And somebody was like, with Dave, you know, he was coming to this club when he was 17, and you could just tell. You could just tell. This is when Chappelle's show was on. And I remember as a struggling nobody comedian, nobody in show business, just being like, screw you, man. Like, everybody has this, like, hindsight, you know, where they're like, you could just, could you? And to that I say, it's not like, I'm not Chappelle, but I am a working comedian and have been for a long time. Could you tell with me? I was right there. And that's how I felt at the time.
But did you question it, or are you this confident?
That's where it gets gross.
Okay.
That, like, I sometimes people
you made
wonder,
it gross.
I'm about to make it gross. But there's a beautiful, grotesque confidence that you can keep to yourself. People like certainty, and they don't like cockiness. Cockiness is if you really let that inner glow take the wheel, you sound like an asshole. You know what I mean? And nobody is drawn to that. But you can have, you can lean into your certainty, which is delusional when you start.
It's the same bell curve.
Exactly. But you want to, I never considered quitting. A lot of the people that I started with, we just kind of found each other. We weren't better. There were people there that were way funnier, way better than us. But we knew for our crop, like, we were these little sprouts. We were like the best of our little crop. You know what I mean? And we kind of took comfort in each other. And we just didn't talk about quitting. We never, and this isn't that talk where you're like, you can't quit. But we didn't. It just wasn't part of my reality. I was like, I love comedy.
I wonder where that comes from, like that certainty, especially looking at your upbringing. And I'm assuming that when your marriage was going off the rails and you decide not to be a youth pastor and you're driving into the city to try comedy, I'm sure your parents were a bit worried.
Luckily, my parents have way too much love for me. Like, they're too loving. You know, My dad was a little bit more distant, meaning he was working all the time. So that was actually kind of good because I'm vying for his attention. But then to this day, my mother is just one of those, like everybody loves Raymond, mothers. And I think a lot of comedians have mothers, some of us, have mothers like that, where you get
and distant fathers.
Oh, exactly, the combo. You get the overinflation from the mother, and you get the drive to prove from your father. And that's where you get this really nice kind of interesting or maybe effective cocktail of, I think I'm great. And then you go up and that's dad. I'm going to prove it to dad. And then you bomb. Dad wasn't buying it tonight. And you get off stage and you're like, but mom says I'm a magical boy. And my poo-poo smells like fresh cinnamon on pine cones. You know what I mean? So mom keeps you going. Dad keeps you fighting. And at the end of it, you hate both of them. No, I'm just kidding.
13 years of therapy later.
Yeah, you've learned to put up boundaries with both of these lunatics who shaped you and made you what you love to be.
That's right. And I think that's true not just of comedians, but of artists. I know that that's true in my case and true with a lot of people I know.
Well, none of them. And I'm talking about a really great crop of Chicago guys, a lot of whom they're all working in different levels and stuff. But none of them, without exception, none of them were doing it to get laid or to have sex. None of them were doing it to get famous. None of them were doing it to get rich. We were aware that those were things that could happen. You know, you see Seinfeld and you're like, oh, wow, look at his cars. But Seinfeld didn't get in this for the cars. You know what I mean? There's an itch inside. It's a wonderful thing. And this is something we talk about on Crashing. It can be good to be compulsive about your work. It can be good to get a certain type of satisfaction you can only get from your work. And what's kind of wonderful about comedy is that you talk about 10,000 hours. It's like, where do you count them, on stage, off stage? Because we're always learning how to be social, how to connect, and how to be funny. But you get those little, it's almost like a drug dealer. You get these like free samples. Like, I make you laugh really hard in the car. And for some reason, some people it's coffee, some people it's music, some people it's wine. Something shoots up you that you go, that's for me. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
I like where you went. I liked where I went when you went there. I'd like to spend as much time as I can there.
Doing that.
And that's, again, that's what Crashing is about. That's why it's romantic. It's like he's doing these things and we shoot at these clubs and I have all these like kind of traumatic flashbacks to what it was like and I have to relive bombs, even though it's extras and you're supposed to bomb, it still hurts your feelings. Like you're up there and your body doesn't know it's a TV show. You start sweating and your mouth gets dry. Why do you do that? My wife, Valerie, who has lots of interests, she's a wonderful musician, all these different things, she kind of says, she says things like, I admire your courage that you went up at open mics and did poorly night after night after night and you didn't quit. And I appreciate that compliment. But what I say to her and anybody listening is, it's because I knew what I needed was in that packet, if that makes sense. It wasn't that I was going, time to steal my resolve and bootstraps and I'm going to go in and slay the dragon. It's because that dragon was holding a packet of what I needed.
Right.
I love laughs. I love...
You love laughs more than you hate bombing.
Exactly. And it's that old thing. I'd rather be a failure at something I love. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sometimes when you do stand-up, and I've never done cocaine. I'm not like a big drug person. But like you get this charge from doing stand-up that is so strong and so potent, it's almost embarrassing how overwhelming it is inside. It's like a crystal from Superman's house and it's glowing white and you swallowed it and it's right here. And then you get off stage and someone's like, we're gonna go get some food. You wanna get some food? And you have to like remind yourself to act normal. You're like, uh-huh, food sounds nice. But inside it's fireworks. And that's why the open mics. Because you hold on to this somewhat delusional belief that even though I'm not very good now, perhaps this ends in me getting more crystals and less bombs.
I wonder if you can be a forensic anthropologist and go back to the point when you first felt that. Those fireworks inside happened.
Oh, the first stand-up feeling.
Yeah.
Because that you're not quite ready for. Like, I was going to tell you the story of being in high school, and I got everyone laughing. I don't even remember how, but I was riffing about Girl Scout cookies.
Not on stage, just at the lunch table.
J-Calf. We had different calves, and one was J-Calf.
J-Calf.
It was the nerd calf. It's the math building. So anyway, we're hanging out, and I just started, and everyone was dying laughing. There was a thing
you were on
happening. Yes, but it stopped becoming about what to say, because I somehow, you know, you just had the riff going. It started becoming about when to say it. So the laugh is coming this way, and you're like dodging it like Neo, and then you find the pocket for the next one, and it felt like conducting a bunch of people laughing. So that's very intoxicating. But the second part of that is I remember like a couple days later, someone else was at the lunch table, and all the other guys were there, and they're like, do that thing, and I couldn't do it. Yeah, I tried.
Right.
But you're kind of like, well, and it didn't work. And that begins the obsession. It's a Robert Klein quote. He's like, anybody can be funny, but can you be funny Friday at 8 o'clock? Two Fridays from now, can you be funny at 8 o'clock? That's a terrifying, I don't even like thinking about that now. To me, stand-up is so much about like getting thoughts like that out of your head, because that's still a frightening thought to me. But you start learning how to recreate a funny thought.
Right. I mean, you still wonder if that will leave you at any time. I mean, can you be funny two Fridays from now?
I've been doing it 17 years.
No, but the point being.
And if I'm not, by the way, it's because you make peace with the idea that you're not everybody's cup of tea. You know what I'm saying? You take some of the stakes out of it. And maturity as a performer, and something that my character Pete on Gratching really has to figure out, is realizing that just because you're not for them, just because something ends, doesn't mean it was a failure. You can go up and kill here. Because you didn't waver, you didn't pander, you knew maybe even what they would like. You saw the guy that went up before you and he crushed talking about diarrhea. And then you're up there and you're kind of like trying to talk about something more personal or what, well, nothing's more personal than diarrhea, but you know what I mean. You're trying to talk about something different.
Sure.
Maybe a little bit more subtle or something. And it's not working. But if you stick to it, even though you bombed, you could kill for you. So you kind of change the stakes. Like if I go, there's plenty of places I would go and do very badly. That's just the nature of stand-up.
I wondered about that. I wonder if half of the success in comedy is you got to know the room you're in and be in the right room for you.
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
It's like somebody tells Pete in the second season, there are some rooms you don't want to kill for. Meaning if what you do, like Dimitri Martin in real life inspired a lot of I actually asked him to play the part, but I think he's moving away from playing himself, which I completely understand. But I did tell him, like, you changed my life, because he came to the Boston, and I was barking, and he came up. I was the only one who knew who he was, but I was like, holy cow, this is one of my favorite comedians. And then he went up, and real Pete, I'm so used to talking about the show, I call him Pete, but real Pete, me, sat in the back. The Boston's built inch for inch the same. And I'm sitting in the back, and I'm like, how is Dimitri going to do? Because what I was doing wasn't that dissimilar from Dimitri. It's not that I was doing one-liners and he's his own guy, but I was trying to make people laugh about ice packs and RoboCop and ninjas or whatever it was. And I was following a lot of guys talking about sex. I like sex jokes, but I was following a lot of sex jokes.
Right.
And then I would have to go up and be like, you know those fake cobwebs they put up at Halloween? That's got to be weird for the real spiders. You know, and it's just like, that's a fine joke. I like that joke.
I like that joke.
But imagine you just followed a guy talking, I don't even want to say. You know what I mean? Like just something really, really graphic. Not just sex, but like something super graphic and maybe super hilarious. But it wasn't my place. So here comes Dimitri, and all of his jokes are very, I think that night he did his joke
cerebral
about like,
or?
He's very cerebral. He's like, swimming is a sport, but sometimes you also do it to not die. And he goes, so I'm watching him do this joke. He's like, sometimes you can tell by the outfit. You're like, bathing suit, okay. Pants, uh-oh. That's a very subtle joke. I love that joke.
Yeah.
And he does it, and it doesn't work. And this was him killing for him. He didn't waver. He didn't change. He just did his thing. He didn't sweat. He even said, I know I'm not your cup of tea. He said it to the audience. And I was like, you can just do that.
Wow.
You can just say like, I don't know. But like, obviously, there's something so traumatic that could happen that you can be crushed. I'm not saying we're invincible. But at a certain point, you develop enough of a skin to go, this is what I do. I see you're not liking it. Boy, I wish you were, but
yeah.
I can't change me.
Well, there's a thing that you say that I read that it really resonated with me. You said that sometimes when you're young, you're bombing so bad that you throw all your values out to get a laugh.
I have a lot of traumatic memories being in front of hundreds of unsatisfied people and knowing kind of what they wanted. And it's not that I can just shift and start being dirty and kill, but you do sell yourself out a little bit. I'm what I call comedy conservative. I'm like, if you're performing for the audience of The Price is Right, and it's a lot of old people, or it's a lot of whatever, it's a lot of, do that kind of act. Like, I like clocks telling time, and I like comedians being funny, but I get it. Like, there's an icky side to it. It's like, right. What if that's not who you are? I happen to be lucky that what I look like and who I am...
They line up.
...lines up with being able to please a lot of people, which is why it goes back to what we were saying at the beginning. I will say motherfucker in my act, and little old ladies after the show say, I love how clean you are, because for some reason it doesn't land.
It doesn't land on them.
It doesn't land, because I look like their grandchildren or something, but that is like figuring out who you are and being who you are. That's why I don't like people, it's too strong to say I don't like people, but like people who are dirty, Bill is dirty or whatever, swears a lot and likes getting touching nerves. That's who he is. You know what I mean?
If you did that, it wouldn't be
right.
You.
It's not right. Just be who you are, and people love it. That's why there's room for so many different personalities in comedy that might not fit anywhere else. On Crashing, I get to work with a lot of comedians, and obviously most of my friends are comedians. And one of the things that makes them so compelling and fun is because they know who they are really, really well. So sometimes it's not that I do have a lot of Val's friends aren't comedians, they become my friends, and I have non-comedian friends as well. It's like sometimes you notice that they're just a little bit behind in just being more declarative about who they are. You might see them apologizing for an opinion. And even with Val, I'll catch her, we were talking about the Lumineers and with a musician friend of ours, and our musician friend, who's very hip and cool, was kind of like, not like the friggin' Lumineers.
Right.
And Val, who's very sweet and like me as a people pleaser, is like, yeah, totally. And then I just go, we love the Lumineers. We listen to the Lumineers all the time. And then I just go, we have bad taste in music. Like, we don't have cool taste in music. We just like what we like. And that's the comedian. And, right. And even Val just being adjacent to me, I see her learning that sort of like, if you're embarrassed, there's other ways to diffuse it other than masking your feeling. You can double down and be like, I like the Lumineers, man. I guess that makes me stupid. But man, I just like some bluegrass that's not too threatening, you know? Like, it's okay. Like, why not? That's freedom, and that's what makes comedians so compelling. And that's also what my character on the show is learning. It's like, these people with their demons and their qualities are just right there to be accessed.
I never thought of that before. Like, once you become a comedian and the majority of your friends are comedians, you go out to a normal dinner party where people are...
figuring it out.
And I guess you would feel ahead of them. That's so interesting.
There's
because
just a bit
also,
of a lag. It's
also
a bit of a lag.
Normal people in normal life do not get immediate feedback in terms of anonymously being able to insult you. And that gives you an advantage over... civilians.
It's instilled.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have practice remaining yourself under duress. So Crashing is the result of my podcast, which you reference as You Made It Weird. And it's a very personal podcast. It's conversations like the one we're having right now. And what it was an experiment, meaning I told you I was kind of private about these things, shameful things. It's shameful that your wife left you.
Right.
You couldn't satisfy her. Like, you're embarrassed. That's what people think. And then you start like a gas leak. You start just letting out a little bit of vulnerability.
Like, to test it a little bit.
And just see, like, what you're really doing is what all people are doing in all situations, but you get to do more of it, which is like, am I going to lose love? You don't even think, will I gain love by being more vulnerable?
That's not even on the table.
Yeah,
you're like,
yeah.
Can I just stay in the room if I tell people this?
Is there going to be some sort of shaming? Are people going to hate me? Once they know who I am, surely they'll leave. Right?
Yes.
And then you see that it's the opposite. The more specific you are, the more people, I'm not going to say love you, but they start to connect to you. So you're feeling less isolated.
Or the people who weren't going to connect with you anyway drop off, and it makes it clearer.
That's it. I'm not your cup of tea. It's okay. It's all this practice of seeing that the more embarrassing things I can share on the podcast, the less alone I feel. And then actually the more loved you feel. And then you get emboldened to do something like crashing, which is different.
Right. That's interesting that the show came out of your podcast. The idea that on your podcast, it was a test for you to see, can I do this? And then once you find out it works there, then...
And by the way, to people listening or watching, if you're being yourself and you are losing love, get those people away from you.
Right.
I'm a big self-love person, but that doesn't mean I surrender to the things that I need to, like, tinker with. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I hate when people are just like, I'm a blabbermouth. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
I can't keep secrets.
That's right.
Work on that, Diane. Like, why are you acting like the game is over? I'm sorry. I'm an asshole.
You got to assume they want to be a blabbermouth.
Exactly. They're doing what they want. But I forgot what I was about to say.
Well, there was a thing about self-awareness there of
Oh, right. Dr. Seuss, of course. Doctor says, be who you are because those who mind don't matter and those who matter don't mind, which is brilliant. I mean, he has so many great quotes, but that's like one of my favorites. It's like, be who you are, like deep down, aside from your peccadilloes and your bad breath and your close talking, but who you really are in your gut.
Be who you are with good grooming habits.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about. We brush our teeth for you, not me, you know. It's
like that. Right.
And that's okay. But like I it does sadden me to see people not realizing that you can hang out and surround yourself with people that are green lights instead of red lights. And that's a big thing on my podcast is whoever the guest is, I try and be a green light area for them. Even if they say something that I might fundamentally disagree with or initially disagree with. We follow it. It's almost like therapy. It's a safe space where we're just like, well, let's explore that. Like, I'm not trying to trick you. I'm your friend. I'm with it. We're building a table together. The conversation is a table. But like, it gives it a jolt. I notice when people kind of set a tone of lively, almost like Italian family style conversation. Because you know, you've been interviewed. I've been interviewed. People are just like, what's the hardest thing you've learned doing comedy is the death of everything.
Sure. Or what's your favorite this or what was the worst experience of this?
Like, but if you can take how you doing today or how was finding parking or what did you have for lunch and then end as we like to with what's the meaning of life or what's the hardest time you've laughed or how many times have you had your heart broken? That's the real stuff. And so few people have real conversations. I think it's a little bit strange that I've compartmentalized mine into something that I, you know, upload to the internet for others, be that as it may, I feel very grateful that most days I get to sit down with somebody for 2-3 hours.
Is that why you still do it? I mean, because at this point you could say, well, you've done it. I mean, what are you on, episode 350 or something of your podcast?
Yeah.
What is the draw to keep doing it for you?
Well, it's funny. I did notice that when we're shooting Crashing, it might be good to go to once a month or something.
Right.
Like that's a new thing. Like if we get to do a third season, I think I would go to once a month just for the summer. So that's something that I'm coming to terms with a little bit, meaning when I'm also in the midst of filming a show, which is 14 hours of basically this, people poking and then acting,
holy,
pretending and then rewriting. And it's a lot of work. And to answer your question truly, is the reason I don't want to stop is even with the show and the stand-up and all these kind of different things, the podcast feels like the purest expression of who I am and what I'm doing. So I love finding fans.
It's like
that
improv,
way.
Right? I mean, you're just literally talking from the hip.
Right.
It's coming out as you're thinking it and
right.
You're listening.
Super, super important. It's a human need. And also, so sometimes the quick answer is I go, when will you tire of having amazing conversations? Like, I don't think I would. So people often, I'm happy to say, oh, your podcast changed my life. And I'm like, or some other nice thing, but grandiose, big things like that.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, it changed mine too. Like, or I learned so much from your podcast. Me too. Like, it's awesome. That's kind of where we get that whole idea of like, don't surrender to the thing that you know is kind of not what you want. For you, like the flaw, the person that's just like, I'm bad about trying new restaurants. Go to the Ethiopian place.
Right.
That's
why. Don't define yourself in a way that's reductive.
With what you are, you know, like let's try and expand. We're only here. We're in these. My friend Duncan Trussell likes to say, we're in these spacesuits that help us breathe and live in this atmosphere, and they're decaying. Like, do some stuff. Grow. Figure out what everything kind of tastes like and looks like and feels like. Know yourself. Be like, I like the Lumineers. Like, isn't that trippy?
Yeah.
I love talking. And unfortunately, I mean, it just is what it is. I like talking about myself. It's the person I know the best. You know what I mean? I'm an expert.
And it's a mystery too, isn't it?
It's every a mystery. Day. I'm also trying to figure it out. I feel one of the meanings of life is to really get a nice clear picture. Like, wow, okay, interesting. We all kind of feel like the stars of our own movies. So I feel qualified to talk about Pete Holmes because I'm Pete Holmesing the hell out of this Pete Holmes. So I like talking about myself, but maybe that's not right. And Val is so sweet and loving and patient. She would listen to me talk and that would not have been a problem. So it wasn't for fear of a scolding from her. It's just kind of going like, oh no, I'm doing that. But I'm fortunate, very fortunate, that I found outlets. You carve out, you're this weird person who's addicted to laughs, who's addicted to communicating and connecting, and who's addicted to conversation or whatever it might be, and attention and giving, whatever it might be. And I have a choice to make. I can either just be the guy at a party that you ask me how I am and I talk your ear off and I'm drunk and I smell like cheese. And that guy sucks.
You got something on your shirt.
Exactly, of course. And there's like one piece of rice right here. Well, let me tell you, growing up in New Brunswick, two Jersey jokes, I don't know why. But I want to be clear, I love New Jersey. Listen, I want to be liked. What I'm saying is, finding outlets and appropriate avenues for all sorts of feelings. I have to imagine this is what wrestlers or boxers or football players feel like, is they channel these sort of larger than life emotions for destruction and domination and you wanna end your strength. And instead of being that guy at the party, you know, I have to imagine you might meet a guy, a boxer at a party, he's not gonna be like, oh yeah, I'll take you down. He found the avenue for it.
Yeah.
He might do that in the pre-fight, like, stare down, but he's probably not going to do it at a party.
But it's quite amazing and fascinating that you found the antidote to talking about yourself all the time was to create a show about you.
I know.
And it's kind of amazing that you turned your compulsion and what you love to do and who you really are into your art.
Right.
And now you've almost had this self-fulfilling prophecy of, it's actually good to talk about myself and think about myself all the time.
Right. Like, it's kind of, I'm not going to say it's gross, but it's certainly a little bit grotesque that my appetite for this sort of self-inquiry and joking and self-exploration or whatever it is led to not only a stand-up career and not only a podcast, but also a TV show where I play Pete Holmes and I'm in every scene.
And you mine your entire
and
past.
And I'm reliving things I've already done and punching it up for others to consume, that
right.
I might even further see my own reflection in their eyes. And I don't mean that in like a pride way. I'm just like, is this who I am? Is this what life is? And you get this feedback, right? And it feels good. But my appetite for that is large. So I have these inner wolves and they wanna take over and they wanna make me the guy at the party with the rice and the bad breath. And I'll just bore everybody and like a vampire, just kind of sucking from everybody. Instead, I'm trying to do the best with what I have, the wolves. You feed them, and then once they're kind of satiated, you actually free up a little bit of hard drive in your brain to take in other people. And this is I'm almost 40. This is where I should be. I'm not ahead of schedule. I'm basically right on schedule, meaning now is the time to go, I know who I am. I can feed that. Let's quiet that down enough so I can really love Valerie. My marriage this time is very different from my first marriage. My first marriage, she was with a guy who had like nine wolves, you know what I mean?
Right.
Now Valerie lives with a keeper of wolves. And we know some of them might get crazy and maybe I'll get up in the middle of the night and I have anxiety or whatever it might be. But for the most part, they're good, you know? And that means we have the rest of the grounds that are wolf-free to go around and allow her to plant a garden or for us to grow things together or just relax and stop playing the wolf game for 5 minutes.
Well, listen, this is the point where I regret that this show is not longer because
you did to me what I do. I go, it's been an hour?
Yes, but you know, just sort of getting into the inner workings that created this show, it's fascinating.
I appreciate that.
And I'm I'm blown away by your show. I can't. I hope it goes many, many seasons.
And, thank you.
And it's been nice getting to know you a little bit. Although I feel like there's a lot more, and people
That's
should
about
listen.
It.
People should listen to your podcast as a companion piece to Crashing, because it's sort of like the you know, the DVD extras to the show.
Totally. And you can even see where jokes and ideas originated. Like something I said on You Made It Weird becomes a story on Crashing.
Yes.
Which I think is almost like, it's like, I don't want to call it the master course, but it's like the immersion course. It's like, I really want to mainline this story. There's a way to do it.
Well, it seems like everything you do is discovery for the other things you do. And
yeah.
And that's, I mean, that's the life of an artist, right?
Like, ideally. Well, buckets catching drips from every other project, yeah.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. But this was awesome. Hopefully it informs the essence of the show, and I hope people see that in Crashing.
Very much so. Thank you for doing this.
Thanks, buddy.
Hey folks, that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed Pete Holmes' Pete Holmesing the hell out of Pete Holmes, because I sure did. And if you haven't heard his podcast, go subscribe to that. It's called You Made It Weird, and it's the kind of podcast that can start with, did you find parking okay? And end with the meaning of life. Seriously, it's a great podcast. And be sure to check out HBO's Crashing for a real inside baseball look at comedy. And if you want an inside baseball deep dive into off-camera, the best way to do that is to go to our website, offcamera.com. There you'll find access to our entire archive of shows and the off-camera store, where you can find magazines, t-shirts, and even the new coffee table volume, Off-Camera the Portraits. Visiting the off-camera store is a great way to support what we're doing over here. And it'll give you access to so many creative conversations. Make sure you check out our monthly subscription, where you can get access to every off-camera show. And while you're there, subscribe to our email newsletter so you can be kept up to date on everything we're doing. If you're one of those social media type people who can't get enough throughout the week, we recommend you go to Off-Camera Show at Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. You can also find me. I'm Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram and Sam Jones on Twitter. And if you want to send me an email, I'm sam@offcamera.com. Drop me a line, tell me what you think of the show. I want to thank everybody that works on the show. Nathan Shields, Michaela Galvin, Crawford Shippey, Amy Jones, Kara Johnson. And just back from his custodians convention in Barstow, California, Matt Davidson. We also want to wish a fond farewell to Laura Kemper, who has taken a job as a travel correspondent for Kemper Industries. And as we speak, is probably sitting on a beach in Greece somewhere. Thanks for all your help, Laura, and we wish you all the best. And most importantly, please join us next time when I sit down with trilingual award-winning actress Diane Kruger.
I met somebody who allowed me to come in and sit in on self-help groups. And what I took away from all the terrible stories is the sense that all of them had this rage that in 1 second their life changed. I really saw that. I started to get this acute sense of responsibility that I'm actually somehow the voice of these people.
The German-born actress was first introduced to American audiences in 2004 as Helen of Troy opposite Brad Pitt. And despite being labeled too beautiful for substance by New York Times film critic Manola Dargis, Kruger has gone on to have a career that is both substantive and successful in 3 different countries. It includes amazing performances in the French film Farewell, My Queen, Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds, and her astonishing and heartbreaking performance in the award-winning film In the Fade. Diane joins me to talk about the pressure she felt preparing for that film, how she has built an international acting career, and how a difficult upbringing led to an independent creative path. See you next time, off camera.